Hello, everybody. Welcome to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is What Would Save the World. My name is Tuke Edelo, and I'm on every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. and every Thursday as a rebroadcast from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. And today I'm here with Lex Pelger, this awesome neuroscientist that I've known through a bunch of my activist friends. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my background's in biochemistry, but then after doing some lab work, I hit the road for a whole bunch of years and started writing about drugs. And so now my angle as a drug writer is I can know the neurochemistry, but also I know how stuff's really getting used out in the real world, whether it be Burning Man or up at 125th Street in Harlem or wherever, trying to find out how people are really using these drugs.
So how are people really using these drugs?
In ways so varied that it astounds me constantly.
Like, you think that, specifically something like marijuana, because I know that you're working on this book right now. You want to tell me a little bit about the book?
The heart of the book I'm working on is about cannabis for grandmothers. And that's, I think, the most important part about this coming liberalization of cannabis laws. The better part of the dark side is less people of color will be going to prison as we make this more legal. The light side, the low-hanging fruit of medicine, is that there will be more access for the elderly to all kinds of different cannabis medicines, not only smoking it, which I don't think elderly people really need to do ever unless they enjoy it because they used to when they were young hippies, but they can use vape pens for acute flare-ups of pain or other conditions. They can use CBD oil or cannabis tinctures every day as a nice background-level protection kind of thing. Or if your grandparent is very nervous about trying cannabis, you can give them a salve or a topical, and those work really well for pain, for arthritis, for stuff like that, for skin conditions. And that can almost be the gateway drug for getting your grandparent or aunt or uncle into cannabis as a medicine. And once they see how well the salve works, maybe they'll be willing to try something else.
Maybe a little more open. Yeah. And also, so CBD, what does that stand for? Because most people are just familiar with THC.
And THC was the first molecule we found, and everyone knows the stoning molecule, but it seems like CBD, cannabidiol, is the molecule that does a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to healing out of this plant. And the best part about it is that it doesn't get you high at all. Not to say it's not psychoactive. It can wake somebody up about like a cup of tea can wake somebody up. But that's the main side effect you can report to the elderly person in your life. You can tell them that they can order this on the internet from a reputable company like Bluebird Botanical is one I always like to recommend. And they'll ship CBD oil directly to your house. And the great part is just put in your tea every morning. Take it in the evening. Find out what works for you. And they don't have to get high at all. But it does so much of the heavy lifting when it comes to neuroprotection for all kinds of disease. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS, ALS. The evidence is really there between the mouse data and the stories from elderly people around the country who don't care about pot as some kind of fun thing. The only reason they care about marijuana is because it was the last drug they tried after all the pharmaceuticals they tried with their doctors didn't work. They finally gave marijuana a try because somebody told them to. Turns out it worked really well. And that's what spreads hearts and minds.
And were you just saying that it can be preventative for things like Alzheimer's? Is that what you were saying?
It's incredibly neuroprotective. It seems to be a really great drug, not only for the brain injuries that football players get, but also as an emergency treatment for stroke and things like that.
Really? I didn't know that one.
It protects the brains in ways that we're still only beginning to fathom, but the evidence is completely there. If there's any disease that it's very well proven for, it's multiple sclerosis or MS, which is interesting because not only is it a neurodegenerative disease, it's also an autoimmune disease. And so your brain is actually getting attacked by your own immune system. And the two things where cannabinoids work so well that it's astounding is autoimmune disorders and neurodegenerative disorders. And so since
like depression also, right? Is that a neurodegenerative? Maybe, I don't know.
I wouldn't say anybody knows. That plays into it, seems to be part of it, and it seems to be part of what makes cannabinoids such a healing molecule is they are causing neurogenesis. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but it's very well proven that, at least in the animals that are very similar to us, weed is growing new brain cells. And it's not just the cannabinoids. It seems to be how ketamine is also working for depression. It seems to be how psychedelics are also working.
That's what you told me when I first met you. I talked to you about ketamine. I told you my experience with ketamine, about how it allowed me to recall memories. and when I was, I like forgot something at my job, and I did ketamine with my friends, and they were trying to do some crazy seance, which I thought was total bullshit. And I snorted a little bit of ketamine, and I realized I had taken the key from the register and was able to write down all of the numbers of all the money from earlier that day. And I couldn't even fathom like how I would remember that because I'm so bad with numbers. And I went back the next day and all the numbers were right. I was off by like 2 cents. So, and then I told you that story and you were like, oh, that sounds like ketamine because neurogenesis.
It is. I mean, ketamine is a whole story in itself and maybe even my second book because it's such a fascinating drug. It is the double-edged sword of our generation. On the good side, it's incredible for depression. It's incredible for some people, for complex regional pain syndrome and for things like that. But on the flip side, I think anybody who goes out to clubs, party scenes, festivals sees what happens to people when they get psychologically addicted to ketamine. It's not really a physical dependence kind of drug, but that small doses seem to let you bow out from the world a little bit and just get that concept of all those people who you think are annoyed by you or, you know, are on your bad side, they actually probably don't think about you all that much. And that distance that ketamine can give if you do a small amount every 3 weeks is very powerful. But if you start doing it all the time, you start sucked into this K-hole removed from reality. And it really can suck people down. And it physically isn't doing them much damage, but psychologically, it can really be a whirlpool that's very hard to escape. I call it the John Lilly effect because that's a famous guy who seemed to have his relationship with consensual reality rather disturbed, you could say.
So, yeah, ketamine is one of the only things I've ever done where I'm like, wow, I should avoid this because I could become addicted because it was so great. Like,
she's seductive more than almost any other drug. You can keep doing it every day constantly. You can do little bits all the time. And so you see anesthesiologists who have lots of access to it because it's the drug used for infants and elderly.
And also animals, right?
Yes. Not the big animals. It's actually bullshit when they say it's a horse tranquilizer.
It's a cat tranquilizer. PCP is the horse tranquilizer. Right?
Yeah. Well, PCP isn't used much anymore either because the side effects are so harsh compared to some of the newer stuff. It's just not potent enough for horses. But for animals and cats, it is.
So something that I've been thinking about is, because I remember you mentioned like every 3 weeks somebody can take it. Maybe I misunderstood. I remember when I first met you, you told me it was something where like ketamine could be taken like once a month or something, or every other month for somebody. It could help them with depression feasibly. And I keep thinking that maybe the pharmaceutical companies are not going to approve that for research, because is ketamine really inexpensive to make?
Yes.
Because they use it on cats all the time. So do you think that has anything to do with it, why they won't fund the research?
Well, they don't need to. It's already an approved drug, and so any doctor can prescribe it off-label. And so that means there's no money in the research because it's already out of patent, so anybody can use it. On the flip side, that means any doctor can study it. And in most major American cities at this point, there are doctors who have ketamine clinics set up, and they often charge quite high for, you know, $60 of ketamine or something.
That's messed up.
Yeah, but on the flip side, they can provide very safe, gentle places. It depends on the levels that you want to be doing. For people with very severe untreated depression or people with complex regional pain syndrome, they might need an intravenous couple hours shots of ketamine to really help them, and it might be more like every couple days to really help.
Oh,
but
really?
It's a very nuanced drug, and everybody can react differently, so you really have to know yourself and work with your doctor. But for people more on the healthy end of the spectrum, to use it as a every couple week treatment for depression all by yourself can be a really lovely ritual. And the nice part is you don't really need the drug. If you say every 3 weeks, Sunday evening, I'm going to put on really good music, light one candle, lay in my bed with just myself for 2 hours of this experience, then even if you didn't take ketamine, that would probably be a healing thing for you.
That makes sense.
I think we all know that the drug in itself can be more helpful.
Do you think that most people would benefit from like a guided thing where it's being not, they don't just have access to it because of how addictive it can be?
The nice part about it is it doesn't have to be guided, it feels like, because so much of it seems to be the drug doing it yourself. which is curious because with things like LSD or MDMA as psychotherapeutic tools, it's very helpful to have a sitter there who's going to help you deal with the stuff coming out, because those are much more, as Leo Zeff said, like taking the blanket out back and beating the hell out of it.
Yeah, LSD is scary.
All that Although, stuff comes out.
That can also, I've heard that LSD could help with alcoholism. It could help cluster headaches, psilocybin and LSD cluster headaches.
Yeah, it's what the psychedelics can do as a medicine are only really starting to be explored. And it's too bad that we're having this generation gap where it's going to be seen as a scientific dark age where we just ignored a tool, just like the church wanted to ban early telescopes. And there was pushback against microscopes for showing too much that didn't make sense. But it's only a blip. These tools are far too powerful for so many different diseases we're only starting to realize, for them to be kept in the closet forever.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely. I think about that a lot. Actually, we're in the dark ages for a lot of different things. I feel like we're in this weird period, especially on like in the topic of race. Like, we don't talk about private prisons that much. Like, people are just starting to. But I feel like for the past, you know, since the civil rights movement, people have just been like, yay, racism's over. It's like, not really. Slavery still exists. It's called private prisons, mass incarceration. And so like that, and like with marijuana, like, because, you know, it's starting to become legal, but it's still being like fought in a big way. Like, I heard, is medical marijuana now legal in New York, but for only certain things? That's what somebody told me.
Yeah, there's now 25 states and the District of Columbia that have some form of medical, and New York State arguably has the very worst laws in the country. Only New Jersey rivals it for shoddiness. And here, you pretty much have to see the angel of death around the corner. There's only a couple approved conditions. And even worse, the medicine is, there's 5 licenses for the entire state, and each of them can only have 3 stores total. So for this entire very large state, at the very end of rollout, you're going to only have 15 facilities. And there's not allowed to have any smoked material. There's restrictions on the kind of medicine you can have, the kind of strains you can have. And really, it's something that's set up to create an oligopoly of certain companies running all of this. And how it's set up in this state is just ripe for Albany-style cronyism, because the health department gets to choose who gets the licenses. And even how they get to choose it and the criteria they use is somewhat nebulous. And so they can say, well, we like this person's proposal better than this person's proposal. But allowing for that kind of freedom in New York with its history of dealings seems to be one that's ripe for shenanigans. And in any case, it means that the people who are getting access to selling the first legal stuff are going to be white guys with suits, often ones who aren't interested in the plant, haven't been involved in the fight to get here. They're people coming from their finance background. And if there's anything I want to see happen out of this, it would be that the laws get written for some kind of 420K retirement program for old Vietnam-era vet growers who've been doing this for 30 years, making it for their friends, really believing in the medicine and just making enough, or for those grandmother edible medicine makers all across the country who know more about how to use this plant medicinally than most doctors, certainly more than most scientists, because with such a plant with so many different strains, so many different ways to take it in, everybody's individual endocannabinoid system so different, the reactions will always be different. Mm-hmm. And you'll have the majority reaction, the minority reaction, and then so many weird little loopholes that only 30 years of experience with a vast array of patients and different conditions will you really start to get the overall flow of the thing. And even then, it will continuously surprise you because it's such a vastly multi-talented plant. In both the shamanic traditions, it's seen as a multi-headed spirit. In the scientific traditions, they call it the entourage effect, which means that of the 80 cannabinoids in the plant, and then all the terpenes that give it its smell, then all the flavonoids, they all work together in such different ways that each strain is such a different experience that it's much less predictable than almost any other drug or plant we take as humans. It's a very special plant.
Mm-hmm. But it can definitely, obviously it does amazing things. I think that, I think I really need CBD oil, actually. I think that the THC makes me crazy. I got really paranoid on the ferry last night. I started to think that people were going to like try to kill me. And I don't think like that usually. So I think I'm going to take a little bit of a break.
A break's often a good idea. And THC can be helpful for certain mental conditions and smaller doses, but it can also be like throwing flames on the fire, especially with things like psychotic breaks, schizophrenia, depression. You can dig yourself deeper into that wound. But it can also be helpful at small amounts. Maybe if you did one puff Sunday morning and that's it, that can be a very healthy spot.
So I am. So this is going to be like, you know, I don't know as much as you do about all this stuff, but like, does CBD deal with norepinephrine? Is that the word? What am I thinking of? So I'm on Wellbutrin right now, and that's an NDRI. What does the N stand for, that brain chemical?
Isn't it norepinephrine?
Norepinephrine, that's what I'm thinking of. Isn't that the one that calms you? It regulates your...
It can. Wellbutrin's actually a really fascinating drug because technically it's a bath salt. In its real terms, and people don't realize this,
like the bath salt,
yeah,
the
and, and bath salts itself is really a bullshit term because that's how it's being sold as a novelty item in this country. Really, they are the synthetic cathinones, and you have
what's a cathinone?
It's a great history because there's three major stimulant plants, and from the ephedra plant of the Chinese, we got the amphetamines, which now is meth, Ritalin, Adderall, all these like. Excellent uppers, in my opinion. And then there's the cocaine plant and the coca plant, which has the cocaine molecule in it. And then there is the cot plant of Yemen and that region. And around there, they use a plant very similar to how cocaine is used in South America, as in they make some nice teas that are slightly invigorating. They put the plant in their mouth and get a slight buzz. There's certainly people who get addicted to it, but as a plant, it's a little bit harder to really get addicted because it's much less. But the active ingredient is a cathinone. And so they took that cathinone and they made very many synthetic analogs off of it, just like they took amphetamine and they made all these different types of speed. Cathinones are just a little bit less efficient version of a lot of the speeds you know. There's a MDMA version of a cathinones called methylone. There's methcathinone, which is a cathinone version of methamphetamine. And Wellbutrin is also a cathinone. And my therapist friends here in the city really find it to be a very distinctly special molecule. It's not like the SSRIs. It's not like the tricyclic antidepressants. It's its own category. And because it can just be, for some people, a little bit of an upper, really. Mm-hmm. And that's all you need to be normal. But unlike an upper like Adderall, which can be very... linear, organize your record collection kind of thing, cathinones can be a little bit more warm, invigorating, and just a little bit of energy for your day. You know, not so much that it's beating the depression as it's just giving you something more equivalent to a cup of coffee that just gets you out there and gets your day and that job done, and you're happy because you got your work done that day. And so often that's where happiness comes from.
I heard that in Europe, those kinds of drugs are more common, like NDRIs.
Yeah, there's a lot more healthier prescribing patterns on that side of the pond.
Why do you think in America specifically we have such a hard time? But why do you think the FDA is so weird?
The American people have always been guzzlers. There's actually, whatever it is in our mindset, it's always been there. You go back and you look at Alexei de Tocqueville going around the country looking at prisons, and all the Europeans of the time were remarking on, my God, do these Americans drink and smoke and do all of these other drugs? And for whatever reason, compared to Europeans or lots of other people groups, Americans love to take large amounts of drugs. We've always been into individualism, guns. All of this stuff is very basic to whatever the American spirit, American dream is. And so when we talk about places like Portugal that has such sane drug laws of decriminalizing everything and trying to treat it like a treatment program, that's an excellent model.
Wait, where is this? I'm sorry.
Portugal has some of the most sane drug laws in the world because you can't go to prison for personal use. They can order you into treatment programs and they can take other non-penal approaches to dealing with you, but it is trying to turn this drug problem into a public health problem, not a matter for cops and judges.
Yeah,
a matter
exactly.
For social workers and nurses.
Yes, I think that even if you're dealing drugs, I don't think anybody should go to prison for nonviolent crimes ever. Like, I think that there should be like outpatient prison where you go to like workshops and stuff, or like outpatient, you know, stuff like for that, like treatment for addiction. Because I think that I don't know what it's like in other countries. It's like Portugal, it sounds like they have it a little better. I feel like here addiction is not necessarily treated as a mental illness, which it is. People want to talk about it like it's like people demonize addicts here. And it's like very upsetting for me because I live in Staten Island, and Staten Island has the highest percentage of heroin addicts in all the boroughs. And I thought that before, I thought about like running for city council for a minute, because I thought it could be really cool to figure out how to get them all housing, clean needles, but extreme access to condoms and food, because all those things would put them in, and also treatment if they want it, like put them in the right conditions to be able to get clean.
Yeah, that's the sane approach that would be not only the most humane thing to do, it's actually also the way for a city like New York to save the most money. The economists who study this stuff, they realize you give enough housing to people, you're going to solve so many of the problems of that you see out there. It actually is a money saver at the end. Even if you have no heart, it's better for the bottom line.
Is it really? That's a good selling point.
But anyone's going to disagree with that. And it often doesn't make gut sense to people. That's the hard part about being a scientist in this world, is that the data so often doesn't matter. The science might have been there on this stuff for the last 100 years, like cannabis. Doesn't matter where the data is. It matters that you personally know a medical patient, or you personally know an addict and realize that they are a human being. Mm-hmm. And that I hope that this might be moving the same direction that mental health has over the last century. Maybe we're two generations behind, where two generations ago, you wouldn't even mention that you had someone with depression or some kind of illness like that in your family. And it was completely under the table.
Yeah,
but eventually it was seen that it's not completely under their control. It is somewhat, and people are still their own agents, but schizophrenia and depression, it's not. And hopefully mental health will be going that same direction as well, where the main thing is support and help and seeing that this isn't somebody's fault, mm-hmm. necessarily, even though it might very much seem that way, especially after your 10th time of getting screwed by them.
Yeah, especially people don't realize that people who get addicted to things probably had problems already, that this is just, clouding it for them or exacerbating it.
I think one of the most important people and thinkers about that is Dr. Gabor Mate out of Vancouver, because he's there on their Lower East Side, which is one of the epicenters of intravenous drug use on North American continent. But that city is the best harm reduction city in North America by far. My friends in San Francisco say they want to make their city look more like Vancouver. There is a safe injection site called Insight where you can go. It looks like a beauty parlor. There's a bunch of slots set up where you can go and inject your drugs in front of nurses who will be taking care of you in case anything goes wrong. And for all kinds of metrics, they are saving lives and reducing harm. And Gabor Mate helped to set this up, but it was very much a local drug user union that did it. The people did it, and he helped to put a face on it. But one of his most important points is that the people you see on the street as the most in the thralls of addiction and having problems, he talks to these people, and the stories of abuse as a child are always horrific. He sees it mostly as there's a neurochemical explanation that I think will make us feel worse about how we treat children in this country, because if a child is abused at such a young age, before they know what's going on, it fundamentally alters your neurochemistry, and your endorphin receptors are forever lower for the rest of your life. And so the line you hear so often is that the first time I took a shot of heroin, it was like the first time I felt a hug, because your levels for this happiness molecule of endorphin weren't high enough to look at somebody's face and realize that they really meant that smile that they were giving you. And so it takes, for so many people, just a little bit of an opiate to feel normal. Which is fascinating. If you need a little bit more serotonin to feel normal and you take a little bit of Prozac, that's completely fine. If you need a little bit more dopamine to feel normal and you take Adderall every day, well, that's okay. But if you're a lower class person, you take a little bit of meth every day just to balance yourself out, which is a fine option that many people do, then you're criminalized.
And you think that it's fine for people to do meth?
Absolutely. I think meth, so much of the work of Andy Warhol's factory ran on methamphetamine. As far as stimulants go, which have always been a tool of creative people around the world, methamphetamine, of the amphetamines, is the most emotional and grounded of them. It's very easy to go too hard because it's a very, at high doses, it's a very intense drug. But compared to Adderall or Ritalin, those drugs are much more boxy and logical. And with meth, people so often, they just want to stay awake and experience more life. When I ride the Greyhound around the country, people into meth, even if they're off at the time, they want to hear your story. They want to tell your story. They want to be awake more, living life more. It's a drug of connection and living, especially when you first get into it.
But you don't think that it's, like, scary. I mean, it's scary because it destroys lives.
It can destroy lives just like any drug. But the thing that the Drug Policy Alliance says, and so many other smart practitioners, is the majority of all drug use by humankind is non-problematic. Whatever drug you've heard of, even the bad drugs, quote unquote, like heroin and meth, the majority of people using them are using them on the weekends to enjoy themselves, probably paying a little bit of punishment on Monday morning like you do from alcohol. But the majority of people do not go on to addiction.
Really? And you don't think the majority?
The numbers for that one are absolutely clear.
For meth?
Yeah, for meth, for heroin. It's so often that it would be some kind of addiction anyway. If it's not these drugs, it can be sex, it can be food, it can be stealing, it can be money or gambling. And so often it is the disease of addiction, as Gabor Mate and other people say, is best treated by connection.
So who is this Mate? Is he the person you were talking about from the...
He wrote the book In the Realm of the Hungry Ghosts. And it is a very on-the-street level look at what addiction is, seeing the very worst of addiction in one of the very hardest spots in North America. But the fascinating part is he also talks about his own addiction, which is to buying classical music, which in the beginning, everyone reading this is a little bit, I think, put off by this. Oh, yeah, a classical music addiction. How does this really relate to someone into heroin? But he was at one point spending thousands of dollars going down to record stores. And he actually left a woman who was delivering a baby because there was a new drop of some classical music. He went to his regular store. They didn't have it. He drove out of the city while this woman was waiting for him to deliver her baby to go get the stuff. And he lost a large part of his emotional life to this obsession. And it just – and he said this is a moderate obsession, but it is absolutely on the
– spectrum of addiction.
And everybody is on some kind of spectrum of addiction. Everybody's having habits, and it's only a matter of degrees of how much happiness you're taking away from your own life. It is not the drug. It is the behavior that keeps you away from authentically experiencing yourself and other people.
That makes sense. But do you think that, like, there are some drugs that are just, like, riskier for addiction? Like, but you just said that you think, like, you know, some of that, you know, if it wasn't that, it would be something else. But, like, do you think it's the same degree of destruction? Like, do you think if someone, I mean, I don't know, I guess, like, personally, I always discourage friends from doing heroin or meth. I'm like, just smoke some weed. Like, do you, like, encourage people to try those things? Or are you just like, I guess I'm just trying to understand a little more.
It's an important question. And the main thing I try to encourage always is moderation. And that seems to be where the healthiest drug use is for everybody. You know, I think you can use small amounts of heroin every day just to get through your day, much better than if you were dabbing huge amounts of cannabis every day. You know, 5-gram dabs all the time is a fundamentally different beast than smoking a little bit of pot. And if it's an addictive personality, then it's more going after that shot and that thrill. And moderate use in any of this stuff seems to be the key to unlocking whatever it is. There are for every addict you see on the street addicted to heroin, there is one medical doctor in the country that matches them. There's a huge number of addicted doctors in this country because they have such easy access. And they have one of the most unhappy jobs in the country, one of the highest rates of suicide.
They have to watch people die and stuff.
And it's not a nice profession like it used to be. It now sucks. They got into this and now they're being eaten alive by insurance companies. They have to put less time in. It's a stressful job. And so many of them still get away with either using heroin itself or using some kind of synthetic opiates like oxycodone because all they need is a small bit to just get through the day. And one of the most important is one of the founders of Johns Hopkins University. He was a lifelong morphine addict. He always struggled with it. He was very ashamed of it. The show The Nick is based on his being a genius as well as someone trying to hide a fairly heavy morphine habit. But there are a lot of doctors who get away with that because they have the social protection of their field, but also because for so many people, for the majority of people, if they have a nice, stable environment, a moderate amount of drug use is either going to be somewhat enriching, or at least the drag on your life is worth it. It's not so bad. If we can have alcohol as a legal drug that most people use on the weekends, that is the most toxic drug to the human body, the only drug that poisons every single organ, and its harms don't even compare it to tobacco. And really, there are only two drugs actually killing Americans, and that's tobacco and alcohol. And that's,
I believe that.
Yeah, the numbers are astonishing.
But so I think that I feel like, as someone who grew, I keep reacting to the heroin thing and being like, oh my God, but heroin. I wonder if that's like a stigma thing. Like, I would personally never try heroin because I'd be too scared. But do you think that like most people have a hard time with it in moderation? Or you think just like a lot of people, I think you said already that most people are just doing it on weekends.
Yeah, the thing to remember with heroin is that for most people, they're just not into it. If your endorphin levels are at a certain spot, it's probably not the thing you need so much. It's not the neurotransmitter you might be weak on, if you will, if you want to take it to that level. And William Burroughs is the guy to look at because he's one of the smartest heroin sociologists in the entire world. And in Junkie, he said, it takes a couple of months to acquire a real habit. It's actually a lot more like tobacco. You don't like smoking tobacco usually when you first start it, but you keep doing it and there is a nice feedback thing there that you start to get into, but it takes a while to get into heroin. And for most people, the first time they do it, what they experience is very unpleasant. You throw up, your skin itches, all of this annoying stuff, and a lot of people never want to do it again. And you might have to go through that experience a couple of times before you start to really get the warm, fuzzy effects that other people are talking about. And so,
do you think like people who are really, really going to get addicted to do it, like, maybe it's like the first time. Does anybody have it the first time? Or you were mentioning like somebody who doesn't, maybe it was like as like abused as a child. They have it and it's the first time. It's like the first hug.
I think absolutely it can fill a gap that someone always needed in their life. And I think certain drugs for certain people can be like that time you got eyeglasses when you were about 14 and you forgot that the world could look this differently. And for a kid with ADHD really bad and they get a little bit of upper, legal upper, and all of a sudden, I didn't know I could function like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of people, heroin can do that same thing. And the place to look is Switzerland for sure, because they have heroin-assisted therapy there, which basically means if you consider yourself an addict, the state will give you as much heroin as you want all the time. You just do it there in front of them. You can show up and get it. But
you can't take it with you. You have to do it there.
I believe you can't take it with you, but I'm not even sure on that part. In any case, what happens to the majority, for the vast majority, is they slowly taper off their use until they don't need it anymore. And then for 10 to 20%, I'd say, they just get down to lower and lower uses until they just have a nice background use that they're using every day, like someone would use any other medication that just kind of keeps them balanced out. And so that is how heroin could be for so many people. And it's part of so much of the danger of heroin is you don't know the purity of what you're getting.
Yeah, that's another thing. Like with meth, like it would have to be made by people who really know what they're doing, which is not most people making this stuff for the street.
Correct. And that's the thing. If you are someone living on the street homeless and your choices are alcohol or heroin, pure heroin is much less toxic on your body. What heroin truly does is put your body in a refrigerator state. And as Burroughs said, you can just stare at your shoe for hours. You often don't shit for weeks on end. And he had very pure heroin because he had a trust fund. He never had to worry about it too much. And so he had a very good life. Most of the deaths in this country come from not knowing the purity and from naloxone, the overdose stopper medicine, not being out there enough.
Oh, yeah. Is that the same as Suboxone, or is that a new one?
No, Suboxone's a treatment, but naloxone is an injection, like in...
Oh, if you're overdosing, you could just take it, and it's supposed to help you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's another thing.
All the endorphins off your...
I should know about
receptors.
That for my future Staten Island plan. Yeah, have that read actively available in a lot of places.
And now it's very easy to get naloxone in the city. And cops are very into carrying it because policemen
really
want to save lives. And they might be against the marijuana liberalization because then it takes away this great tool for you know, keeping down the long hairs and the lowlifes and the people of color that they don't like. But they want to see, they want to save lives. Everybody wants to be a hero. And if you can have this medicine that will stop someone from dying in front of you, everybody's going to be into that. And so it's interesting to hear from someone like Ethan Nadelman at the Drug Policy Alliance. When he goes to these big cop meetings, they're still very much against the pot thing, but they are behind the naloxone thing. Mm-hmm. Because everyone has sympathy for this opiate epidemic. Most people.
Mm-hmm. So you think the larger problem is addiction rather than the actual drugs? I think we've talked about this a little bit.
I think the largest problem is lack of connection.
Lack of connection.
And in a country that has a social blanket that is so frayed after the work of Reagan that it's just an incredibly hard place to live as a human being in the middle. We are at the bottom for so many metrics in the first world, from birth stuff to health stuff to housing stuff. There are parts of this country that are absolutely worse than large swaths of the third world. And
like Flint, Michigan, maybe?
Exactly. Or in West Virginia. And these places are getting no help. And you see what happens to people groups when there is no hope. There is no jobs. There is no support. There is no health care. And why not take drugs? And that's one of the most important things to come out of the mouse research around this is something called Rat Park, which is mentioned in most any good book you'll read on addiction. And there's a great comic, in fact, online by Stuart McMillan that explains all of this. But basically, the idea was all of this work on studying addiction in animals and mice and rats was done when the mice live in these boring little cages with food and water, and it's just bare plastic. So instead, this researcher, Bruce Alexander, built Rat Park, which was a beautiful mecca for rodents. There were games to play, lots of different types of food, females that you could have fun with. There were places to run. It was a rat city that was really great. And then they started repeating all the old experiments on rats dosing cocaine. You can have as much cocaine or heroin as you might want. Just keep pushing the levers. And they started looking at this, and animals who came in who were addicted to these drugs in their boring cages, you put them in the nice cage, they didn't want the drugs anymore.
That's actually, I tell people this all the time when I talk. You don't know me that well. When I was traveling before I lived on the commune, I was traveling all over the country and hitchhiking. And the places where the most people were on meth were the bumfuck middle of nowhere. That's where the meth problem, like, addicts were. Me and my friend were hitchhiking through this little town, and the cop pulls up and scans our IDs and goes, I don't want to see you bringing any meth into this town. And we're like, fine, we don't do meth. We're on our way out anyway. But I always tell people, like, if you're in the middle of nowhere, there's probably meth.
Yeah, and Terrence McKenna said it really well about these drugs being the drugs of war zones, of refugee camps, of places of despair. And if there is no option but doing these drugs and there's nothing else to do with your day, with your life, of course, why not? Why not take them? And I don't want to downplay how terrible the crisis is in this country. I've done a lot of traveling in the Midwest and in the South. And to go to these towns in Arkansas where everybody you meet has a person affected by meth, terribly bad. The pastor's wife as well. And it's one of the saddest things going on. And there are no easy solutions here. The solutions are compassion. The solutions are healthcare. The solutions is more housing. The solutions is a better economy with more actual work for people.
And like you said, like connection, like warmth. Like I think about this all the time, like just how people need more warmth. I think about that a lot. I also... They were like trading a dog around for meth in the desert. Like they just kept trading this poor puppy around. It was the saddest thing. Just like watching them like sell their dog to just get high.
Wow.
Yeah. Dark stuff.
It is. It's the really hard stuff. And there are some easy solutions, but most of them are very, very structural and ingrained in human society and American society specifically with this individualistic ethos.
Ayn Rand type stuff. So I actually want to go back to, you said that, how do you think Reagan contributed to this?
The more I study Reagan, the more he amazes me for the amount of evil empire he spread. Nixon really doesn't even compare. Nixon was a weaselly, petty politician who was very effective what he did, but he was a weasel. Ronald Reagan was a perfect front in the way that he operated. And no matter how intelligent or unintelligent you might think he was, his people were so good. And in the war on drugs, which is the part I know best, they took the CIA's already deep involvement with the heroin trade and protecting routes and using this to prop up right-wing dictatorships and took it to a whole other level and turned the United States into one – the United States Secret Services into one of the largest drug-dealing organizations in the world. And none of what I'm saying is even close to conspiracy theory. This is lots of excellent books of journalism behind all of this stuff.
Do you think the Secret Service are still drug dealers?
Still. With what the CIA has in control in Afghanistan, it's hard to imagine not. When you look back at Vietnam and the work of McCoy's The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, that showed the Air America in Vietnam was being used by Thai generals to fly this stuff. So often it was, we would allow you to do these drugs to prop you up because then we don't have to fund you. The drugs can fund you. But with the Contra scandal and all of these things, what the CIA does at the international level is seen in the microcosm of how narcotics officers operate in all American major cities, which is they need to have their finger in the game to know anything. It's partially of how the game is set up. With a victimless crime where nobody involved is going to be reporting it, you have to be involved in it to know what's going on. And so narcotics units in the States, they have their protected dealers who can tell them what's going on. And there's always well-verified stories of the local narcotics officers going and robbing drug dealers. In San Francisco, they were the ones who wore – you got robbed by beefy men wearing Hawaiian shirts. That was the SF narcs who were robbing you, which meant you couldn't report them. And that same stuff is happening in New York. And so you have to – that's how it goes. To keep yourself in the game, you have to be somewhat involved in it. And it's not to say that they're running all of the drugs into the city, because it's always so many flows of different gangs and people working together, but they're always in bed. They know what's going on, and there is complicity there that usually doesn't get reported on, but when it does, it makes it clear how much these patterns are repeating internationally, nationally, and then down to the local level.
Mm-hmm. That's so crazy.
And actually, what really makes sense is J. Edgar Hoover would never let his FBI agents touch drugs. He always kept the FBI away from drugs because he said they are so naturally corrupting to any officer of justice because there's so much free money floating around. You have to get in bed with the bad guys to get anything done. And so the CIA was always looking for bagmen, ways to make money. And this is one of the best slush funds for any kind of money around the world to fund this propping up of right-wing dictatorships, to knocking over democratically elected governments. And so I think it's notable for someone who is fiendishly intelligent as Hoover to say, this is the most corrupting influence in law enforcement, is this free-for-all spot.
So you were talking about like the narcs and stuff, but those are – they're police, right? Those are police. So you're saying that like the police actually are drug gangs?
In most cities, there and you can never call police one unit. You can never call the CIA one unit.
Different departments,
which is always important that you remember. There, I think most in any of those organizations are men and women trying to do their best by their mission, especially with the people around them. But there are always those elements who think they're still doing a good job and get sucked into this morally gray whirlpool of thinking you're doing the right thing, and all of a sudden you are complicit in it and you're playing the same kind of game, because to catch a crook, you need to be a crook much of the time. And so it's disheartening, because before this war on drugs, there was a much closer relationship between the American populace and their police. There was a lot more trust there. And this just gave them so much power to be assholes. And for the certain percentage that are already wired like assholes, you will get to be more of an asshole. If that option wasn't there, I would hope we would have a more Andy Griffith-style And I think most cops are probably Andy Griffith style.
Oh, see, I have it. Maybe I'm a cynic. I always feel like most of the cops are like the kids who got bullied and are now bullies.
And the truth is in there somewhere. And it's when I'm around my anarchist friends, I really want to stress how you have to think that most of these cops are doing what they think is right for the world. Even if you think that they're completely wrong in their viewpoint.
I'm that little anarchist kid.
Very few people are monsters. That's the hardest part about it, is that their motivations are probably good.
Their motivations are probably good. And this, I was thinking, you know, this whole like crooks thing, that they might be kind of assholes. I think that, again, probably comes from the lack of connection. I think most people who behave aggressively were treated aggressively as children, or like faced abuse, didn't feel enough connection. So, but I keep thinking about how we keep talking about drugs and they can be used for different people for different things. And we talked about how a lot of addiction comes from people not having connection. And I think what I'm hearing is you think that drugs are also great for connection also. So these can be used as tools to help with the problem. So drugs can be helped. I mean, drugs can be used to help with the problems that people use drugs for.
Exactly. And it's one of the most fascinating parts is that any of the drugs that we think classically as good for enhancing connection, whether that be LSD at a party or ayahuasca in a spiritual circle or weed just to enjoy yourself with your friends.
Or MDMA.
Or MDMA to open yourself up, or ketamine for lovemaking. All of these can be incredible tools of connection. And the great part is you don't actually need the drugs. I always tell my father, for a great mushroom trip, if I tell all my friends we're going to go in the woods on Sunday and we're going to hang out all day, that is an important drug-type experience of itself. I think the mushrooms help. But the intention of setting up some kind of sacred space, really, for ourselves.
The brain chemical is getting released.
And because all of these drugs, all of these experiences come from within the human mind. And all of the experiences that these drugs unlock are available to any human being. You can use your yoga or your Buddhist practices to get to states as wild as anything you've seen on acid. To watch a holotropic breathwork session where people are breathing heavier and faster for a couple hours. You see stuff that's intense as any ayahuasca circle you've ever experienced. To see someone like William Blake, who probably didn't do any drugs, but look at that work. Does it not look like that man is soaked in DMT? It's hard to imagine him not, but some people are just naturally more attuned to what all of us have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I want to talk a little bit about your book more. You have a book. You were talking about how it's the grandmother's use of weed, but the graphic novel.
Yeah, the heart of the book is that I'm really trying to get across is weed for grandmothers. Not only because it's sexy, but also because that's who people believe. I have so many elderly women around the country who, since it's a graphic novel, I can have them turn to the camera and say, listen, here's what worked for me. Here's what I learned. I can't speak to anyone else's experiences, but this worked well for me. And the stories will just blow you away. It's still continually blowing me away how often it can just make diseases go poof. Not that it does that for everybody, but it is astounding. As someone who's been studying drugs for 10 years now, compared to any of the other plant medicines almost, and a lot of the pharmaceuticals, it really stands out as a healer. But so what I want to do in my book, the main thing I'm doing new is talking about the endocannabinoid system and the fact that we actually have these cannabinoids in our head that are being produced as an incredibly important neurotransmitter. So not only is THC coming in and doing stuff, it's working with this own system we already have. Just like morphine from the opium plant helped us to discover our own endorphin system about a century ago, the much more recent story is when we discovered THC in 1964 as the active ingredient in marijuana. That led us to, about 20 years later, discovering we have receptors specifically for cannabinoids in our brain. And they're actually incredibly widespread, one of the most widespread of that class of receptors in the brain. And then later on, we found anandamide, which is my great white whale. The first neurotransmitter we ever found that is a cannabinoid. Because if you have the receptor, that means the brain is probably using it.
And that's where the Moby Dick graphic novel thing
comes in. That's where the Moby Dick thing came in. So if you follow me at all on social media.
Which I do.
Yeah, that'll explain a lot of the whale references that you get. I mean, I also think it's the best thing ever written by an American. But that's the side point about it, is half of Moby Dick is about Captain Ahab, which is American imperialism, is about turning men of color and whales into blood and money. It's about what's coming in terms of industrial capitalism. And and the heartlessness of the American dream. And so that is the war on drugs. That's a continuation of slavery in this nation. So whenever he talks about the Ahab side, I'm talking about the war on drugs side, which keeps repeating from Reefer Madness of Anslinger to Nixon to Reagan, and it keeps on going.
Yeah, the war on drugs is a huge problem. It's connected to so many issues, like the prison system, the mental health. We've been talking about this whole show.
It's really the dark side of what the American dream is and how heartless a nation it can be, a nation that is on land stolen by genocide, enriched by black blood, and then built on the blood of and the work of the immigrants who came in over the last century. I mean, it is an incredibly inhospitable nation in a lot of ways and ranks at the bottom of the first world on a lot of metrics of decency, of what counts as a good life. And so that's the dark side of what this war on drugs has been. But for me, the light side, the whale, is cannabis as a medicine. Not only do I want to dive in the science of how we figured all this stuff out, because I'm a scientist and I think it's fascinating and it hasn't been covered in depth in the popular press yet, but really what's astounding is cannabis as a medicine. The history goes back through all the major empires you've ever heard of. It is incredibly important plant medicine. The two oldest plant medicines, as far as I can tell, in widespread human use are opium and cannabis. And they very much relate to each other because we have an endorphin system and we have an endocannabinoid system. And they twist around each other like two snakes in a lot of ways. And so because the endocannabinoid system and the receptors are all over the highest parts of our brain, and the CB2 receptors are on every organ in our bodies and somehow relate and communicate with the immune system to the brain. It's some kind of homeostasis system for the body, as far as we can tell after 30 or 40 years of research, which isn't that much as far as science goes. And so, but even from what we have, from the preclinical work in mice, which is a tremendous amount, it took me years to really get my head around the basics of how much mouse work has been done. Then the 20,000 Americans who have gone through clinical trials for all kinds of different methods. And then, most importantly, all of the grandmothers and patients and doctors collecting stories around the country of anecdotal evidence. And unfortunately, in modern day science, when you say anecdotal evidence, there are quote marks around it because it's evidence, but it's lesser evidence. It's bastard evidence, which is such bullshit that if it's not peer-reviewed, it doesn't count. Because so many of these drugs or these diseases, only a couple thousand people in the world have them. So if this grandmother says, Sonny, after every other drug on the planet, this is the only one that works for me, that's important. And so that's why, personally, in my book, I have around 100 different diseases. I feel like there's enough good scientific evidence from preclinical, clinical, and anecdotal to make a good case for that it's worth mentioning. And that's a crazy number, 100 different diseases. There's almost nothing in terms of our pharmacopoeia that rivals that, maybe except for prednisone and the other immunosuppressants. But those are horse pills that knock down your immune system. So they do a lot of different things. The cannabinoids modulate your immune system as well as doing many other things. But that's part of the reason that they work so well. Wherever you're out of balance, the cannabinoids seem to come in and balance you out. And since most diseases seem to be a lack of balance in something, even if we don't know what that something specifically is, it's part of the explanation why cannabinoids work so well. They are very much the original yin and yang medicine.
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about how, you know, anecdotal evidence. Did you see this video when Romney was running for president, when there was this young boy who had MS and he said to him, why are you against the legalization of medical marijuana? It's the only thing that works. It's the only thing that works. And Romney just was like, oh, well, you have marijuana. He was like, no, that makes me sick. That doesn't work. I need marijuana. It's the only thing that works. And Romney just like walked away. I feel like that's like a great metaphor there for what's happening in a lot of ways around marijuana.
You're right. It's a picture perfect example
of how terrible it is. It's not perfect.
Yeah. The data has been there for a century, ever since LaGuardia's report during World War II. It's as good a piece of science on what cannabis can be as a medicine and the harms from it as has ever been produced. And since then, the science has been clear. Every other blue ribbon commission by any government across the world has found the same basic conclusions about cannabis, exactly what you would expect. Very helpful for some things, probably makes some other things worse. Overall, not nearly a bigger risk as most of the other drugs.
And also, don't people think that like hemp can help out with like power in terms of like electricity? I've heard stuff like that.
Yeah, there's an amazing amount of things that the hemp plant can do and has done in human history. It's one of the most widespread uses because it can be a fiber, and it can be, it was paper. Some of the first books were printed on it, and canvas or wars fought over hemp, just like there are now wars being fought over oil. It was that kind of, it was illegal to export rags from certain cities because rags are made of hemp, and then they would have, and that was part of the magic of paper, and paper is one of the great human magics as far as things go. The hard part about hemp is so much of what it was originally good for is now been surpassed by synthetics. And you might not like these synthetics, whether they be plastics or more organic materials, but one of the hard parts for me is there's a lot of older men specifically who love hemp and think it will solve all the world's problems. But if you look at a report from the Rand, for instance, looking at hemp,
the
research think tank often used by the Department of Defense, but
so not anything related to Ayn Rand.
No. They're a good. Great think tank.
She's a curse word. Yeah. No, I mean, I like some of her stuff, but I have my problems with her.
Yeah, no, Rand. I mean, Rand can be a curse word to a lot of people. They work. They do Department of Defense funding too, but they're also a great source of, you know, acceptable wisdom to the middle of the road political type people. And so their work on drug stuff is great. And so the thing with hemp, though, is hemp is legal almost everywhere else in the world. And it's not being used as any kind of great heal-all for anything. And it's not, if the market would solve that problem. If hemp was the cheapest thing to use, people would be using it. And unfortunately, it's not anymore. If this world was more sustainably minded and thought a little bit more green, yes, hemp would absolutely be used more. But it is no longer going to be a panacea. I think of all the uses, there are certain, and this really pisses people off, and I can hear people grinding their teeth right now about their pet use, whether that be hempcrete or energy generation or things like that. But it is... I think the medical side is actually the most important.
I would agree with you, of course. You know, health and mental health are the most important things. So we have only like a few more minutes left. I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show, Lex. So I want to let people know where they can find out more information about you and your books. Where is that?
It's actually really good timing. If you go to lexpelger.com, I just released the first sample chapter from my book. And it's actually based around Reagan and AIDS and his homophobia that led to his ignoring the AIDS crisis, and that led to medical marijuana becoming an idea in this nation. And so it's really a howl for queer folk right now. And it's online and it's free. It's a 61-page graphic novel. And if anyone out there, it's a tribute to the queer heroes who got us here and fought for their rights, like Leonard Matlovich. And so if you have any queer friends, I would send it on to them. It's not that much about pot.
I'm gonna post this on my Facebook page, facebook.com/whatwouldsavetheworld. I'm here every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. Every Thursday, it's a rebroadcast from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. I mean, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. I want to thank you so much, Lex, for coming on here. So I just wanted to close out with that. We have another minute. But I want to say, have you ever heard of Dana Beale?
Sure.
Yeah, I know.
One of the original cowboy smuggler geniuses.
Now he's a problem. I mean, he's not very good with women. I don't care if he hears this. But he did. You do what he did. He got. So if you don't know, Dana Beale got like tons of marijuana to AIDS patients when nobody was listening to AIDS patients.
Yeah, he's an original cowboy smuggler, spending all of his money and energy and time to put himself out of business. He did a lot of work for this movie, and he really knows the neuropsychopharmacology.
Yeah, and now
it's kind of amazing.
Now he's all about ibogaine.
Yes, yeah, which is another incredible plant cure.
Yeah, so we could talk about ibogaine for like a minute. We have like for like 10 seconds. So thank you so much for coming out here. I'm so excited. Tune in next week. Thank you so much for listening, and, you know, fuck the drug war.
Amen.
And the drug war.